Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. We're talking over the best matchups from the 2023 season. It's just in our rearview mirror now. We've got a long, extensive offseason to get through. So we thought, why not bring up some of the best moments from the past season, some of the toughest games, toughest battles. Daniel, what was kind of your thought process going into these games? You and I both came up with blind lists as to what our five favorite matchups were, and they ended up being identical. So we're going to go over the same games that both of us chose on our own. Yeah. But what was kind of your thought process? For me, it was a little bit of obviously close matchups. All five games that we're going to talk about here today were one goal victories for the winning team. However, it felt like there were some very deserving candidates left off, despite them not necessarily finishing the closest. There were some other overtime games that we couldn't quite nail down to the absolute apex tier top five of the season. But I just kind of felt like closeness, limiting turnovers, big play potential, obviously, big highlights, kind of those moments that encapsulate the entire game's atmosphere and energy. And then also big player performances. Was there a star who kind of came up out of the din and noise and melee of the battle and sort of put themselves above the rest of the competitors? And it feels like each of these five games have those components to them. But what was kind of your deciding factors going into this thought exercise?
Yeah, I think you nailed like the component breakdown. I took it as kind of a much more like gut feeling and just remembering kind of the energy and vibe of the game when I was watching it, like how into it I was, how I felt like in the fourth quarter and overtime, like my heart was physically beating fast for a lot of these finishes. And I just, there's something about a lot of these games are like rivalry games and the stakes are just elevated in so many of these. So yeah, I think to me, it was like more of an unspoken criteria where it was just kind of going on feeling for these five games.
I feel like I'm the gut analyst. I feel like you're always the numbers guy. You've got things.
I know. I was going to say.
A little bit more like proof to your math, whereas I'm kind of like, this is how I feel about something.
I was going to say, with the numbers, like just going, like prepping for this episode, I was watching back through the highlights of these games. I actually didn't really check the stats at all because I was just like, I just wanted to like be back in the moment of watching the game live. And I am checking stats live, but yeah, I think the criteria you mentioned, I'm sure were like all in my mind and what led me to pick these five. So I'm glad we were on the same page though, with like sort of different approaches.
Well, it's probably why we ended up with identical lists, despite going into this totally blind from either end, no real parameters set for either of us in choosing these games. But there were kind of, I think, a consensus around the five games you chose. It felt like some of the highlights of the season. And of course, we'll get to naming them in a second. But I just wanted to take a moment to kind of talk about what you were just referencing about like the vibes of the season, right? I feel like that's such a way to like go about analyzing things in general. I feel like in sports even, there's kind of this, you know, the nerd statistician who's miserable, you know, that meme of two dudes sitting on a bus looking out the windows, and there's one that's miserable compounding math numbers and nerd stuff. And then there's kind of the, he got that dog in him analyst who just kind of talks about the flavor of things, how things feel, how it occurs to them as you kind of just tap into your memory bank and reflect on how a game felt, how you felt in those closing moments. And I just think it's really interesting that even in the immediate aftermath of the season, we're still just kind of left tussling with that. Okay, this game has the fewest turnovers. You know, like one of the games I thought about nominating was the East Division Final, where New York had that seminal performance, the lowest turnovers ever. But it just didn't have that right mouthfeel or something. Wine kind of description, like a sommelier. Like there wasn't, it lacked a certain amount of juice. There wasn't that compulsion, like you say, down the stretch, even as they're kind of like approaching this historical achievement, it just needed something extra, needed that competition level, right?
Yeah, no, it wouldn't have been a bad pick, but I think just the fact that it wasn't, really the closeness of the game, I think, was the biggest factor in that New York one. Like, yes, if you want to watch the best offensive and defensive, most efficient game ever played in AUDL history, watch that game, but was it like the best game overall? No, because it wasn't like that interesting aside from New York dominating, which is what we've been watching them do for years now. So like, was it really that different, that out of the ordinary? Didn't feel it.
Well, you've set me up for a great segue into the first game we're going to be talking about. We'll be working through these five matchups chronologically. So we're going to start in the third week of the season with what else than the greatest rivalry we have in this league, New York at DC. The first matchup between these two teams of 2023, New York, in their last meeting prior to week three, had upended DC's championship weekend aspirations in the 2022 East Division final game on that big birthday boy, Ben Yacht buzzer beater from Jack Williams, another seminal moment in New York's extensive history at thwarting DC at the buzzer. So week three had all these kind of auspices to it, right? Like DC gets to host New York. New York is kind of coming off of, I think, one of their more vulnerable looking performances. They went on to obviously dominate the competition at 2022 championship weekend. But in that East Division finale, it gave rise to the idea that's been perpetuated across social media that maybe the second best team in this league actually resides in the East and is New York's greatest rival, the DC Breeze. And so there's kind of this like energy just coming into this matchup in week three between New York and DC that I think elevates it to almost immediately playoff status. You know, like just going into that opening pull, it feels like this matters more than most. This is going to dictate who possibly holds home field playoff advantage in the East Division playoff bracket, who gets to kind of, I think, put more of a word on what had happened in 2022 when there were so many close results between these two teams. There's always that next added chapter that continues to feel like it's the most important one between New York and DC, and it's what makes that rivalry so much fun going into each and every game. Going into this one, it kind of lived up to its auspices immediately. There were just 25 combined turnovers from the two teams. DC had 14. New York had only 11. It was one of the only times that these games had made it into overtime for the past couple seasons. So there was that extra added frame and I think fatigue factor down the stretch that made everything a little bit more volatile. So to see this more mortal version of New York at the hands of the Breeze after all the Breeze's additions in the offseason, it just felt like this is living up to it. And I think even more than that, it was the playmaking for DC that really kind of announced it being a little bit more of a new matchup. You had Christian Boxley going off, asserting himself in his all AUDL campaign that carried out through the rest of the season. You had Ben Ort and Thomas Edmonds, two new big additions, making big, big plays in this game. You had Cole Jurek and Andrew Roy providing so much more stability so that the Boxleys and the Orts could go around and do their playmaking. There was just an added level to it. And yet, despite all these great challenges from DC, you have the Jeff Babbitt game, which I think is what kind of became of this, right? Like there's so many different good competing moments. You know, Oliver Chartok stepped in and had a fantastic game subbing in for his brother Elliot on offense. You have Ryan Osgar bouncing back from his four turnover performance in the East Division title game to go 35 of 35, 450 total yards, a handful of scores, a big hand block in the second half, just a dominant performance from the 2022 MVP. And yet sitting above it all is this man, Babbitt, just crushing it to the front corner, letting everyone know about it, finishing with 7 goals, 3 blocks, 284 receiving yards. And just other than Ben Yacht's sky in overtime, the probably next five most definitive moments of that game felt like they owned to Babbitt. And it wasn't even necessarily highlight plays. It was just him being unguardable in the spaces in which he can get to.
He made them into highlights by the amount of times that he did the same exact thing, cutting to the front cone. And by the end of the game, he let everyone know about it. There's that famous clip of him screaming that he owns the front cone and that no one can stop him and that we're going to be using in highlight reels for years to come. but I still, when I think of that game, I kind of do think of the Ben Yacht sky more so than the Jeff Babbitt performance. I mean, the Babbitt performance obviously is what launched his MVP campaign, like pretty officially and pretty certainly. But the Yacht sky was just like, it's just the purest example. I just love that Brownlee was just like, Yacht's down there somewhere. I'm just going to launch this moon ball. It's the purest example of just letting your best players make a play in the clutch, no matter what the situation is, right? Double coverage, doesn't matter. Throw it up to the big man. And even after he got hand blocked by AJ Merriman at the end of regulation, he's in a different zone in overtime when the game is fully on the line, and he showed it. And I think that is like definitely one of the plays of the year. I don't know. Did you make like a top 10 plays of the year? Did we rank like all of the best plays? Was that in there?
No, there's been like a couple like top number ones, which is like the number one play from each week's top 10, but we'll get to like most exciting moments. There's like best moments from the regular season, which obviously that is a part of, but
yeah,
there's not necessarily like a compendium.
But like, right. When I think of like best moments, and we might get into that in a later episode as well, but like moments of the season, like the yacht catch was just, it was kind of the first big moment, right? This was in week three, and it was just a reminder of who Ben Yacht is and who the New York Empire are in overtime. And I also remember watching that game, and while DC was like coming back and obviously making it super close in the fourth quarter, Ben Ort had multiple goals to really bring them back into that game. At the same time, it still felt inevitable that at some point New York was going to outplay make them. They were going to outperform them in the clutch because they have the luxury of having Yacht, Babbitt, and Jack Williams as pure two-way players for the last like 5+ minutes of the game. And that's just not anything you can match. Any team can match ever, probably.
Didn't mention Jack Williams. He was 52 of 53 on the game. It was one of those weird, Jack feels quiet this game kind of performances. Right. And you go back and realize he was the rock at the center of everything in an OT game against your greatest rival. And so actually he had a stellar performance. I feel like Williams kind of has a little bit of that fog of war sometimes in these matchups where you have, you know, the Babbitt screaming, the Yacht skying, these kind of other large entities. Osgar was playing out of his mind and letting everyone know about it, being very chatty in his matchups with Breeze defenders. Oliver Chartok again kind of ascending into this most improved candidate that he continued to play at throughout the rest of 2023, showing he has added dimensions and just, I think, playmaking to his game this season compared to last. And yet, here's Jack Williams just being a turret of distribution and able to kind of fill in whatever backfield role that they need. Rushmeyer Bailey also just doing a fantastic job. And again, all without Elliot Chartok, who won the East Division Player Choice Awards Best Handler this year. So pretty sizable loss. And I remember thinking like that, I remember previewing that game going in and saying that this is pretty significant. Is this kind of a chink in the armor of New York that DC can potentially take advantage of? Missing one of their backfield components. And of course, the answer, as always, is no when it comes to the New York Empire. But I disagree with you. I felt like this game had that different flavor because of how much DC had the playmaking that they haven't had in previous iterations of this matchup. The Ort play that you mentioned, he was getting deep consistently. Boxley, of course, had that massive sky over an all-defensive first-teamer and John Randolph in the open field. Johnny Malks also had a fantastic game. He produced like crazy in all of the New York matchups this past season. He was on fire, just kind of releasing from the backfield space, being a problem wherever he kind of lined up for the Breeze offense. I felt like they had, and this is almost like what contrasted in the East Division Championship later on in the season, they had this hope to their playmaking, to the spark it could provide. That, like, the finality of that Yacht sky just brought to a crushing close, right? Like, there was an energeticness to how DC was attacking. They hucked like we haven't seen in these matchups in many, many iterations, right? Like, they were attacking deep space. They were going man-on-man against New York downfield, which is not traditionally how they've articulated themselves in these environments. You think about how they clawed back in the 2022 East Division Championship game. It was through a lot of small ball. It was through a lot of their patented kind of work the disc between all seven pieces. Whereas in this week three game, it was kind of bombarding them over the top. I mean, Andrew Roy had a hammer in this game for an assist. Like,
really?
He was feeling it. He was juicy, you know? Like, I just say that because I feel like Roy takes zero chances ever.
Yeah, of course.
Here he is in the closeout of a game, kind of doing these more saucy maneuvers. Obviously, Andrew Roy has a hammer in the bag within the red zone from almost any angle, but I digress. I just thought it was really interesting because it felt like a contour that I hadn't seen in this matchup, and one of the ways in which I thought the Breeze could maybe get some traction, and yet it results in the same damn thing every time, which is a New York dub.
Yeah, I know. It leaves us with the same question after all these games. It's just like, what can it really take? What can be done about this New York team? Because it's clutch performance after clutch performance when these games come down to the wire, and it was the same thing when New York played Philly, what was it, like a couple weeks later, and they went to overtime. But it was just like, it always feels like, all right, like maybe they're not playing so great in regulation, or maybe they let their opponent come back and make it a game. But in the end, they're always going to pull away. And so it's, yeah, there is like a sense of helplessness I get when talking about New York and reflecting on all of their late game heroics that are just inevitable at this point.
Well, luckily for the inevitable team, that's the last time we will be mentioning New York in these rankings here today. So for all those New York haters, rejoice. Empire fans, you can tune out, I guess. Go rub yourselves on the trophies that you're collecting, whatever.
Yeah.
Do you want to take us into our next big game from the 2023 season?
Yeah. So let's jump ahead to week 6, Carolina at DC. And this is the second meeting of the season between Carolina and DC. They met in the first week of the season. Carolina had a lot of roster inconsistency early on, and this was the first game, one of the first games where they really were bringing like an absolutely full strength travel roster to DC. And of course, they would play Philly the next day as well. So it was this intense interdivisional road doubleheader. And playing his third game of the season with the Flyers was Joe White. But this was the first game of the season where they fully committed to having Joe White be a full-time O-line player. And, I mean, the results speak for themselves. This was the Joe White takeover game. I can read you his stats. 10 assists, 3 goals, plus 11 on the night, and he accumulated, what, like 784 total yards.
What I love about that total yards thing, too, is that a lot of times when you start getting a player up past like 700 total yards in any given game, they're kind of lopsided on one particular category.
Yeah.
Either they have this abundance of one set or another. He had 472 receiving yards, 312 throwing yards. Like, he was dominating no matter what you kind of did with him. Put him in the backfield, he's going to complete a bunch of throws. He's 51 of 54 on the game. And another one of my favorite stats, 10 assists, just 1 hockey assist. Man was a finisher the entire night. Like, you just, he's, if you were giving him the disc, it was going into the end zone, like, yep, it or not. And he had that effect, man.
He was the one closing out the game, too. He had those two, like, beautiful leading flicks to the far side of the end zone that were the last few Flyers goals. And it was Joe White from start to finish. He introduced everyone to that beautiful low-release inside backhand that he had, like, how many breaks in a row throwing that same exact throw? DC could not stop it.
That was the next day. The next one was when he spammed it against Philadelphia and had the, like,
on that one possession,
give and go issues where he would just fake the forehand, step through at the backhand, fake the forehand,
so
step through at the backhand. Incredible stuff. Yeah. Incredible stuff.
It was awesome. But yeah, I think we both picked this game just because we're a sucker for a really high level individual performance when it is the pure will of one player to take their team to victory. And I just think it's getting rarer and rarer to see in like today's Ultimate, where it's such a team game and there's so much like small ball and give and go stuff. You just don't get the same intrigue as like one star player taking over. But I feel like we got that in this game, and that was probably the best example of an individual performance we had all season.
Yeah. Well, and both teams were actually equal in a lot of their team metrics. Both just had 4 breaks and 4 red zone turnovers apiece. And on DC's side, Boxley, Malks, Andrew Roy, they combined for 125 of 128 on throws, over 1,500 total yards together as a unit. And yet DC comes up shy yet again. I guess we're a sucker for kind of putting DC fans through this kind of pain vortex of recalling all these close but not quite finishes from a team that feels so able to kind of come out on top in these circumstances. I mean, to your point, they defeated Carolina by 6 goals to begin the season in week one, and then losing at home in this fashion. It's just, it's tough because it's once again one of these Breeze games where you look at it and you go, this is a really solid performance. The other team just played a little bit better. And it's interesting to me that DC so often kind of absorbs a franchise's best punch of the season. Like, week three, New York was maybe one of the most tough matchups of the season, other than the East Division Championship game version they got of them, where they committed a league low 4 turnovers in a game. You know, DC absorbs that. Yeah. Carolina's best game of the season might have been this week 6 win at DC, where they get Joe White hot performance, who goes absolutely nuclear levels of production and just swag that I think encapsulated what the Flyers kind of failed to realize at any other point during the season, which is that as tremendously talented as they are, what is sort of the prevailing identity? Who's kind of the person that we lean into in a given moment? And when they had Joe White as that answer, I mean, you saw it in that matchup. They took a 3-goal lead at one point in the fourth quarter, and were it not for a pretty furious DC rally down the stretch of this game, they would have kind of cruised on the road against the Breeze. And it's just interesting how, you know, quickly changing, ephemeral these moments can be for some of these teams, where DC enters this game 3-1, Carolina 3-2, but Carolina's 2 defeats coming into this game were by 6 to DC and then by 5 to Atlanta a couple weekends prior. And so they had this, I think, massive idea of variance, and they carry it through into this game too. But that was sort of it for Carolina, whereas DC exits this game with 2 losses, each by 1 goal apiece, each basically in the final moments to 2 of the top other franchises in the entire league in New York and Carolina. And we think of as DC, I think, as being diminished from that result. But what I love about the Breeze is that they don't really diminish from all these tough body blows. It feels like they continue to learn the right lessons. They continue to go back and run their game plan and come back and crush teams that they should in other matchups. And I don't know, there's something so encapsulating for this matchup to me. And like, also the Flyers-Breeze rivalry, despite being interdivisional, being one of the better rivalries that we've had over the last several seasons, it just felt very descriptive of both these franchises. Kind of DC being good but not quite enough in some of these A-tier showcase games, and then Carolina showing you a true potential that maybe only comes in 1 or 2 game stretches. There isn't really a realization of, this is who the Flyers are week in, week out. Like, that was even how they were in 2021 when they won a title. You know, they were 0-2 to begin that year. They did the same thing this year. They started off 0-2 and then went on a 3-game winning streak or 4-game winning streak after this game. And it's just like, I don't know. It was kind of back to that juice factor, that it factor. There was something meaty about getting this at week 6, basically the midway point of the regular season, that felt so fitting for these two franchises.
Right. No, I kind of think the losses earlier in the year were good for DC. I mean, they really turned it on in the second half of the season. Like, they were playing very, very good ultimate, and they were just consistently, like, you know, cutting down that turnovers per game number game after game. And so I think the early adversity, I mean, you mentioned Carolina starting 0-2 in 2021. Obviously, we know how that worked out for them. Like, I think there is something to, like, getting some early losses so you sort of have a point that you need to get to where, like, you're going to win those games later in the season. Obviously, DC did all they could and happened to come across New York in the best game ever played. But I also wanted to make the connection because I was thinking back, the other, like, pure individual performance games that I think back to. I mean, the biggest one is the Nethercutt versus Rowan game of 2018, which just crossed my mind is the same exact teams that we got in this one. So something about this DC Carolina rivalry really brings the best out in one specific individual performer.
Yeah, it felt like a 50-point game in the NBA or something. Just somebody kind of going absolutely different supernova level. And it's unfortunate that DC is, again, kind of at the mercy of these. And it's weird, to your point, like DC's defense sort of after this matchup and then not again until they met New York in the playoffs, they really tightened up. It felt like this was one of the last kind of performances that they allowed somebody to go off like White. But, you know, it's similar to scoring in the NBA. There's only so much you can do when a player like Joe White, when a player like even Christian Boxley or Jeff Babbitt get into these zones, these rhythms. There's only so many kind of levers you can pull in this league to prevent offense. And once it gets going, you just see it. It's kind of an unstoppable force. And again, and it's our first two examples are the Jeff Babbitt game in week three and then the Joe White game, both against a DC defense. I think both you and I would absolutely agree is top five in this league.
Yeah, well, Osgar also, remember going into the, to backtrack to the New York DC game, but going into that game, you know, it was coming off the famous Cranston and Jasper Tom limitation of Ryan Osgar, but like, I'm sure he like intentionally had it out that game that he was going to put on a show and be like, no one can really guard me or do anything when I'm in rhythm. And yeah, he showed that in that game. He showed it throughout the season. I don't know. We don't need to spend any more time on New York, but I wanted to mention the Osgar game as well.
I told people we were done with New York for the episode, and now we're starting to bring them drag.
Yeah, we gotta move on. Let's move on.
Decorated bodies, just glittering with crowns and stuff, back into this conversation. It's obnoxious.
Someone's gonna beat them eventually.
Put them back away. We're gonna talk about New York plenty heading into 2024 and what any team can do to try to dispatch them. Let's keep the focus off of them for now.
Yeah.
Let's go out west. We'll talk about our third matchup, the actual second game, the kind of rubber matchup between Colorado and Salt Lake from week 8. This is 1 week following Salt Lake's first ever win against the Summit in Colorado the previous Friday night. Going into this game, Colorado in week 8 was just 5-1, the lone loss coming to Salt Lake, and Salt Lake was 7-0. So this game in week 8, despite Salt Lake winning the week prior, this one felt like the truer one, right? Like there was a more amplified intensity. I felt like with Salt Lake being so close throughout 2022 in their matchups with Colorado and then finally getting a fourth matchup kind of towards the beginning part of this season, it felt like they were almost due in a sense. And that was kind of the raucous nature of their week 7 clash. There were more turnovers. There was a little bit more variance. It was the infamous nether cut to D-line, Spicer to O-line for half the game to start the game for Colorado, which felt very displacing of the entire sort of organizational flow chart of how to understand the Colorado Summit. It's like switching Matt Stafford and Aaron Donald on the Rams or something. Yeah. Let's just try our tackle and our QB sort of figure it out in each other's roles. It's not to take anything away from Salt Lake's first ever win against Colorado. There just was kind of a little bit of a fool's gold feeling to
it.
Well,
it was only a one goal win too. Like it's not like they blew them out. So, yeah, it's just like all these games are going to be super close. Right?
We had all sorts of questions about if they just played Spicer on defense from the beginning of the game, how many extra goals is that essentially worth? Colorado had trouble converting on their break opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. So going into week 8, it just felt like there was so much more building up to this game. It felt like the Summit, even for their part, took that game more seriously heading into week 8. And you could just see that from the way that they approached the first couple points. They kind of reintroduced, I think, the bodaciousness of a deep ball attack that we'd grown so familiar with from their first season as a franchise in 2022. They were doing that to begin in week 8. You know, they were absent Nethercutt, who didn't make the road trip, but in his stead was Alex Atkins being completely unabashed and engaging deep looks. Calvin Stoughton was available, and combined with Finer and Frood, just presented an amount of speed that is completely challenging for any defense in this league. And as athletic as the Shred were, you could just see that there was a little bit more of leverage and pace that the Summit could apply at altitude in Salt Lake in their second matchup this season. But it was kind of conveniently balanced by the Salt Lake machine offense that was just going to take whatever opportunities were given to it. And you could just feel that there was a trimness to this game. I mean, there were just 19 combined turnovers. Salt Lake had a season low 8, or a franchise low, I think. Colorado, I think, also just performed a fantastic game for what they were asked to do against a raucous crowd, road environment, knowing that they had a game the next day. They really brought as much as they possibly could. And yet it felt like because of all of that, there was this sudden, there was this moment about midway through the game where all of a sudden it just clicked into kind of how I felt midway through the 2022 season, where it's like, oh, this Shred team is real. Like, this isn't just a fun highlight filled thing. They didn't just get their one nice win against Colorado in the regular season. This is a Shred team that's actually trying to compete for a title in their second season as a franchise. So Salt Lake is performing at this incredible clip, and it was against the Colorado defense that I think in hindsight, it's hard to remember that by the end of the season, they were dealing with so many injuries and so many adaptations to their lineups that it was not the same Summit defense that we were seeing through the first half of the season. And through week eight, while they still had their injuries to deal with, it felt like they had a lot more of their full strength rotations available, and yet they just didn't have any solutions for sort of the seven strong front that the Salt Lake Shred were employing. And one of the more interesting things, and you and I both realized this looking back, it was the last iteration basically of the Salt Lake offense that didn't include Grant Linsley. It was the version that still had Will Selfridge that had done well throughout the first half of the season, but because Linsley was a remote player, wasn't practicing with the team, they felt like he could provide the most for the Shred by platooning on defense. Neither team led by more than two throughout this entire game. It was a total seesaw affair. As soon as one team started to grab momentum, the other team got it right back. There was just no real breathing room at the margins, which came down to, of course, that final play, Colorado in the red zone, looking to get the game-tying score into the end zone, and rookie Everett Saunders picking off the final pass intended for a Summit player 5 yards deep in the end zone, just streaking up the sideline with the interception as the clock was at double zeros, absolute pandemonium outbreaks all across Zions Bank Stadium, Diet Cokes flying everywhere. I'm sure it was just a complete scene to be in the middle of the sea of. But there, I wanted to ask you, what was like two moments in this game that kind of gave you the flavor of this rivalry? Because I just felt like this deepens the rivalry out West so much more for next season, because we never now get a West Division playoff game between these two teams. LA upsets Colorado, and we never get that kind of it's not really a rubber match if Salt Lake wins the first two. But that third matchup of the 2023 season that we got in 2022 between Colorado and Salt Lake, there's no redemptive sort of third attempt here. And so to leave everything sort of crystallized in Salt Lake swept the season series going into 2024. What kind of like moments leap out to you? Like, what does this game say to you about like where the West Division is at?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the moment that stands out the most to me was Alex Atkins imitating the Selfridge bus driver celebration towards the end of the game. I mean, it was really Alex Atkins played such a perfect game. I mean, obviously had some turnovers,
he had four throwaways, and there were a couple of times.
But I mean, perfect for like the way he filled that QB1 role for that offense. Yes, I guess he had four throwaways, but you're bound to have some throwaways when you're taking over the offense to that extent. And I just felt like Atkins coming in, he's the future of this offense, and I think he also brings like a new clear swagger to this team that they're going to need to compete with the Shred in this West Division. Like the Selfridge celebrations and the fact that Selfridge, this was also like probably his best game of the season. I feel like it was him and McKay Jorgensen really like announcing themselves as really staples for this new Shred roster. Really like the youth is what stands out to me, I guess is what I'm getting at. It's like, it's the Selfridge, McKay Jorgensen, Atkins on the other side, obviously Finer and Stoughton had a big game, like you mentioned before. But this idea of like, these are the guys that I think are going to be competing head to head. Jordan Kerr obviously is in that conversation too for the next several seasons. This is like the new, it's weird to think it's a new era for Colorado because they've only been around for 2 years, but really like the going away from Nethercutt and towards this new offense where it's even more hybrid centric than it was last year. I just think that's, it's an exciting prospect for Colorado. Like kind of coming into their new identity. And I felt like this game was kind of the first glimpse we saw of that.
No, and I want to concur with you. I think for the role Atkins was asked to step into, he absolutely played a great game. I mean, he finished with 4 assists, 4 goals. He had over 60 completions. He had a bucket ton of yards. Like, there
even
was
the red zone too. I like, it was just him. He needed to like take over and really like assert himself in the red zone with give and goes. So like, yeah, perfect one. We can put an asterisk by the word perfect. Maybe that was the wrong choice of words, but yes, fantastic game from Alex Atkins.
You're going on vibes again. It's that new vibe.
It was an Atkins vibe.
You're
game.
Done yeah. just looking at throwaway and turnover numbers. You're back on the train. If, I don't know. He felt kind of like a dog that game. He got a little bit of dog inside of him. No, I mean, yeah, but that's how that team played last year. It felt like Colorado had multiple sort of swagalicious players on their roster last year. It felt like there was this, again, this like bodaciousness, this energy to 2022 Colorado that just wasn't quite there. And this is one of the biggest what if games for me of the entire season. And we're going to get to that at the end of this episode. Some basically what would happen if we flipped a couple of these results and how that would have cascaded out elsewhere in the league. And this has to be top three for me, not only in terms of interesting game, but just what if Colorado got their swagger back from this game? What if they come out of there doing the bus driver to Salt Lake, getting to quiet the crowd, getting to kind of walk out with one last shh, you know, particularly, and we'll get into this even later in the episode, what if they had won by 2 or more and then won the season series advantage? Maybe they don't allow themselves to fall to 4 regular season losses. Maybe they only do have that one loss to Salt Lake. Maybe Salt Lake tips one other time in the rest of their calendar, and maybe Colorado hosts a second straight West Division championship game. Again, we'll get to that later in the episode. But yeah, to your point, I thought Atkins providing that energy, Stoughton too. He's a big talker. He's a big letting you know he's out there scoring on you. I felt like because Colorado didn't win this game, that was kind of the last time we saw them playing like that in 2023. It felt like we saw moments. We saw obviously big plays. They had that crushing win against a semifinalist in Minnesota just a week later. But to all those points, there wasn't sort of the exuberance, the sort of youthful energy that I think has been propelling so much of the Summit successes through their first 2 seasons as a franchise. And it felt like Salt Lake, kind of to your point, proved that they might have the better up-and-coming sort of lineup in this particular West Division format. And that's I think, what truly kind of like also made me go, oh, wow, Salt Lake has arrived. Because I think in my head, even if Salt Lake had won both games, there was always kind of a notion that Colorado was the better team. I think we both kind of entered into the season with that bias. I think we both favor certain aspects of their roster and how their talent is organized, that there's this feeling, again, vibes, for the vibes episode this week, I guess. Yeah. There's just this innate sense that like, well, Colorado's the better team. And it's like, I don't know that that's really clear anymore. You know, I think Salt Lake took that from them in this Week 8 win. And then obviously with how they kind of carried through the rest of their season, being the league runners up to New York in the championship game, kind of acquitted the rest of that thought process. But it's really interesting how much that one game sort of pivoted almost the entire dynamic of how the West Division sees itself. I think it almost led to then the next day, you know, Oakland saying, hey, we have a shot against this Colorado team who just gave everything on the road against their closest rival, and Spiders pull off the upset the next day. That was one of the tough cuts, I think, for both you and I, was Oakland upset in Colorado. But there's something about, you know, teams playing the second game of a back-to-back and getting upset that I always got to apply a little bit of grain of salt. Same thought process with like Carolina falling to Philly in Week 6 after the big win in DC. There's just something as fun and energetic as those games are in the moment, there's always kind of that little bitty asterisk of, well, the other team played an additional game.
Well, Colorado looked so gassed at the end of that Oakland game, too. I mean, it was a fantastic comeback by Oakland. And obviously, they made all the plays down the stretch. But yeah, Colorado was clearly feeling the second game of a doubleheader.
Well, and as Colorado kind of has talked about since, Oakland can be one of the hardest road environments to play in because of how their crowd sits on the field, because it's a wind tunnel stadium. There's a kind of a weird wind, and the Spiders just almost out of their youthful, I think, naivete, just take those elements and play to their strengths, regardless if it means like a 40 combined plus turnover game, as that game ended up being, and as many Spiders home wins ended up being this year. You know, they were one of the, I think, uncleanliest teams as far as how they got W's during the 2023 season. But anyways, let's continue to move on. You've got our next one for us.
Yes, we are going to the playoffs. Done with the regular season. We've recapped all the important ones. You don't have to know about any of the others. But we are going to the South Division Championship game between Austin and Atlanta. And this game is like, so, there's just so many interesting storylines leading up to it. One, you had Austin coming off their biggest win of the season over Carolina. It was a game they played in Austin, but I think we all viewed that as an upset win, just given how successful Carolina has been over the years and how much they've been beating Austin recently. But Austin really showed that even though they played this Texas heavy schedule, they played their best game of the season when it mattered most. So I think there's that famous Kyle Henke quote coming into the game. They kind of felt like they were playing with house money in a sense, because that Carolina was so heavily favored. But now Austin is going to the South Championship, and the specific rivalry between Austin and Atlanta, historically, these teams, even when they were both like kind of around 500 or maybe having losing seasons, they always tended to play really good games against each other, just when you look back historically. And
Austin Atlanta for years has been like a phenomenal undercard. I remember one time in 2016 or 2017, I think it was 2017, I believe, they like neither of them were going to make the playoffs, and they just had like an overtime game randomly in the middle of the season. Thrilling of the entire year. But anyways,
it's great. No, but the year before, I mean, that game that Austin played against Atlanta in Austin, that essentially decided the South Division playoff race, that allowed Austin to get into the playoffs and play Carolina in 2022. And it required like a huge fourth quarter comeback. So anyway, Atlanta was also just like rolling at this time. They'd beaten Carolina twice at the end of the regular season. They seemed like the clear one seed by the end of the year in the South, and definitely the favorites to come out of that division, represent themselves for the first time at championship weekend. And Austin had other plans. I mean, that game coming out, it did seem like it was going Atlanta's way early. Austin was like maybe taking some weird shots, but in the second quarter, I feel like everything just tightened up so much, and both teams were just playing super hard, super efficiently. I remember thinking like the energy of this game is like some of the highest I've seen from either of these teams. And I think Atlanta just had so much pressure on themselves. They just need to play as clean as possible. And Austin was like, let's give this everything we have to try and pull off a second straight upset and make it to our first championship weekend, building on the trajectory of their ascension over the past couple of seasons, you know, starting with their win over Dallas and how they've like overtaken that role in the South. But yeah, really like kind of opposite approaches. Atlanta was just like so much pressure on Atlanta, still playing super well. No pressure on Austin, playing up to Atlanta's level, and just like you got a back and forth grind that in my mind was like the most entertaining start to finish game to watch this season. I mean, we'll get to the championship weekend game we'll talk about later. But for me, like pound for pound, quarter for quarter, this game was incredible. End of the game featured like so many incredible defensive plays in particular. It was anyone's guess who was going to come away with this win. Like, both teams wanted it so much. Atlanta had the game in the hands of Brett Holzmaier, couldn't come down with that last catch to score the game winner. Then they later had a chance in sudden death. Kyle Henke, huge layout block. I don't know. The moments just stack up. Is there like one particular moment that stands out to you more than the others? Or I guess, what is your like, when you think back to the end of regulation, I mean, into overtime, into double overtime?
How about this? The Matt Smith greatest maybe doesn't make it in my top five moments.
Yeah,
of the game. It's moments. I'm not trying to say the difficulty of the player or whatever, but Matt Smith does a no-look greatest the back of the end zone. One of the smoothest plays this league has ever seen.
So good.
probably doesn't crack my top five most important moments from this game. Like that, yeah, that part makes it bonkers. The top five, it would be some combination of obviously the Henke block. I think just the game-winning toss itself, that whole sequence is a fever dream. Just everything to do with it after the Henke block, where it's like
right.
Atlanta gets a second opportunity in Sunday.
Yeah, Austin turned it over.
Throw away like the Oliver Fay block just felt monumental, both in the moment and going back. It feels like it has added weight. The Draco attempted half field hammer to Holzmeier in the closing moments of regulation that ended up being dropped. That goes down as one of the truly most what-if moments of all time in league history. Yeah. And again, we'll get to that kind of at the end of this episode, because I think that this might be my number one what-if. Because I just feel like, again, your point of intro, this matchup, how Atlanta was playing and given their lineup and just given how that team approaches things and given how tuned up Tuba, Bench, and Jaja had them in all their important matchups this year, it felt like they could have maybe had more of a chance in that semifinal matchup against either New York, or I think they would have also drawn Minnesota.
Yeah, what actually would have happened with the seeding?
It would have gotten really crazy, because I think they would have been effectively the 3 seed, because Salt Lake still would have been the 2 seed at 11-1.
Right.
I think. But maybe not, because Atlanta had so many large... I would have to go back and literally subtract point differentials and figure that out, but that'll be for a deeper off-season investment. I already got sidetracked, it like I always do, three into my five top moments from this game, because it's hard to choose from. That entire second half was just sort of call and response, haymaker from either team, and I was just sitting back at the end of that game. That is one of those games, and I always truly hope to get to these moments in games where I kind of put down my note-taking for a moment, and I just, just watch over me. I don't know what's going to happen. I can't really, like, afford to look down, because I want to see the saucy... That was the other thing that really clinched it for this game, and why it's probably just behind the last game that we'll bring up in this chronological order for me is... the atmosphere, kind of what you were alluding to, the intensity and the pressure that everything cooked up to. I know it got there through some ill-gotten physicality that we do not approve of, but there's something to do with the physicality, the way in which Atlanta had their season ended at Austin's hand the season prior, the years of kind of buildup of this slow heating rivalry. There was that extra sauce that was just all over the top of this game, through especially the last two quarters, where it was just like Swiatek caught an upfield scuba pass over somebody at some point in the second half and just looked straight back at his defender and like let it drop next to his head. There's Atlanta players just like talking the whole second half. Bobby Lay works into a Bobby Lay groove in the second half and provides a throwing punch that Atlanta desperately needed. It's one of those games where you could almost take any 5-minute window from it, and it would feel radically different from any other 5-minute window. And I think that's just the composite of a terrific rivalry game. And again, that like added oomph. I don't want to focus on the chippiness, the physicality, because that does suck.
It wasn't, it wasn't about that. I mean, I'll say the crowd was literally all on their feet for like the last, I don't know, 5 minutes of regulation and then into the overtime periods. Like that to me, it was just like, I wish I could have been there. Like I just wanted to be there the whole time as I was watching it. And you felt the energy of the stadium, and you felt the stakes, and you felt the effort and energy that the players were all putting in. Like every single player on the field wanted that win so badly, because it was two teams that had never been a championship weekend before. I think that also just elevated it, right? Like that's naturally going to raise the level of play of everyone. By the way, two other big plays that you didn't mention, the Burnett block in the red zone at the end of regulation, and then Hayden Austin Nabb's snag in overtime.
I was working towards that when I got sidetracked on the Draco.
This was
hammer that would have been a game winner. Like, again, can you imagine how we would have talked about that game already? Like, it's already going to be talked about years and years from now. But if Draco punched Atlanta's first ticket to championship weekend with a half field hammer, basically one of their franchise cornerstones alongside Matt Smith and Brett Holzmeier and everyone. Like, that would have just been nuts. And well, we didn't
Holzmeier was like an MVP candidate this past year. And in the third quarter, he came down with a similar buzzer beater at the end of the third quarter too. And yeah, played great. An unfortunate series of mistakes, unfortunately, led to the Atlanta loss. But I mean, it takes nothing away from the stakes of that game, and just like, yeah, how much going back to vibe that was like the most vibey game I watched all season.
No, the most vibey game is the one we're still holding out on, which I'll just ruin a little bit of the surprise, is Minnesota Salt Lake. I mean, the last 5 minutes of regulation of that was just pure ecstasy for me. So. But getting back to the South Division Championship game, I did want to mention, and kind of occluded in all the other vibe-tastic moments, double overtime glory of this matchup, there were some amazing individual performances. We just listed a handful on Atlanta's side, but on Austin's side, I mean, starting with Kyle Henke, the stat line itself, 4 assists, 3 goals, 2 blocks, including the game-saving block in the end zone layout on Haden Austin-Nabb, who had been kind of one of the solver pieces down the stretch for Atlanta. 529 total yards, 30 of 31. And then alongside him in the offense, finishing with a game-high plus 10, Evan Swiatek, 5 assists, 4 goals, 34 of 34, 366 total yards, and just like always being available for Henke. It felt like there were consistently times in that game where Henke would just kind of plot out where Swiatek was, and they would almost run a little bit of two-man. It was just, it felt like Austin just had this gear and this ability to ascend in pressure that was completely unknown for the other parts of 2023. Like, I've talked with a couple of Atlanta people since that game, and they're just kind of dumbstruck by how Austin played in this game. There was nothing you could have done to prep or scout for the sole team that showed up in the 2022 division title game. I mean,
they were the biggest unknown all season. Yeah, we had no idea what to make of them.
We continually talked about that. We just didn't think that their ceiling would keep getting higher. That's not traditionally how it works for high variance teams. And yet here they are in their biggest game. They're 17 of 18 in the red zone compared to Atlanta's 12 of 18. So 94% versus 67% for the Hustle. Man, and then Austin was 6 of 8 on their defensive chances. Atlanta actually had 2 more break chances, but they were just 4 of 10 converted to less. So that's it. Those are the margins. That's it right there. That's the game.
Yeah. That Austin defense, by the way, that deserves a ton of credit for like how they ascended throughout the year and really put their foot down against Carolina and Atlanta. Like, I think we always knew that they had a lot of talent, but again, just the whole unknown that was over Austin all season, just because of their Texas heavy schedule, you didn't really know to what extent they were like an elite level D-line unit, but I think they showed it both in their defensive intensity and just their ability to convert breaks, and that's what ultimately wins you games a lot of the time, so credit to them as well.
Well, not necessarily, because in the next game, the losing team actually had a higher offensive efficiency than the prevailing team that advanced to the 2023 championship game. We are, of course, referring to the all-time classic instant just monumental game that was the second semifinal on Friday night on August 25th, excuse me. October is coming way too quickly. on August 25th, where Salt Lake prevailed in overtime, just the second overtime game ever at championship weekend, 19-18 over Minnesota in front of a raucous wind chill home crowd. And just this game, I think, was easily, you called the last game most vibey. Last game still just featured 26 combined turnovers between Austin and Atlanta. Minnesota and Salt Lake, by comparison, this game had 38. Almost both teams reaching the 20 turnover mark, which is kind of where it gets into Tunes West Division territory for me, as far as like, all right, if both teams are committing 20 plus turnovers, what is kind of the expected outcome here? Like, there's no real math to what's about to happen next.
Sure.
That's how the end of this semifinal game felt to me, where again, by the end, I'm just sitting back and watching what each team has for me, because Minnesota did such an effective job of making it a rock fight, of making it this kind of central division clash where nothing is going to come easy offensively, and you're going to have to work in the trenches to get any kind of dismovement going. And watching Salt Lake kind of continually work up and respond to that, but kind of have their own errors, there is just a stylistic clash there that I think we so rarely get. And what is so enticing about these championship weekend interdivisional first time ever facing each other matchups, where it's just total unknown, great coaching staffs, love to scout. You have all these anticipations of how the game might look going in, but then when the rubber meets the road, you get kind of this Frankensteinian character, right? Like this kind of amalgam of a bunch of different pieces. Like at the beginning of the game, you get kind of Minnesota not knowing when to take their deep shots correctly. You get some great Salt Lake defensive plays deep, but then as Minnesota starts to calm down a bit, as they settle into their shot taking a bit, you see Salt Lake start to bow a little bit under the pressure of Minnesota's defense and this just electric home crowd that they're fueling off of. And by the time you get to the third and fourth quarters, all the pretense of kind of strategy breaks down. And when you were on the field, I remember you were talking about this, just kind of the intent. I know this is such like a trite way of expressing it, but the intensity of everything, the fatigue that was starting to become visible because of how hard people were playing, it sort of made the other components of what maybe they brought into the game melt away. And by, again, that third and fourth quarter, it was like, it's just this game. Like all that matters is effectively what happens on the next pass. Any pretense of like, we're going to advance into the championship game, and this is what we settle on, these are our goals, like it's gone. Like you are just playing in reptile brain mode where everything is heightened. And there were just so many like tension mistakes, like almost out of anxiety in the second half of this game. And whereas a lot of times we would be, I think, critical of those moments, in this environment, just added to the excitement. It was like, oh man, he got hand blocked.
Right.
That is not how this is supposed to go.
Right. No, I was going to say, it was nice that it was such a dirty looking game from a turnover standpoint, because these were two teams that were totally new to championship weekend. I think there were a lot of young players on both sides, particularly on Salt Lake. And you could see like this team that has had one of the best offenses ever all season long, all of a sudden has just like totally come back down to earth. Like you said, like the playbook is thrown out the window. Everyone's just playing ultimate. Everyone's just trying to like not make mistakes and make the most of what they can. And I think that just led to so much like momentum swings would happen for Minnesota. And then there was just like the boost they got from the crowd. And then if Salt Lake ever answered, it was just like everyone was like waiting for Minnesota to then answer back. Like there was just kind of a constant back and forth. And because of the turnovers, it was just like no offensive possession was a given. You're expecting the D-line to manufacture some breaks every time. And I think that, you know, in contrast with like a New York game where it's just like inevitable that they're going to score their goals every time. And when New York plays DC, it's always like a pretty clean game. This chaos environment really, like you said, I think it loaned itself well to the championship weekend experience.
Yeah, I mean, especially after 2022, where we didn't get any kind of close battle, this just felt so nourishing almost. Like,
it was very nice. Very nice.
At least one of these games at each championship weekend where it just goes down to the absolute final throw, and there's usually two or three plays that are just totally unexpected. And obviously, the chief among them is the Clutton tip disc Hail Mary at the end of regulation, which will exist far beyond probably you and I in this league as far as like a thing. We've talked about before. I've watched that play another several dozen times since. It's just, it again, it fits in to the jigsaw puzzle that was this game, and that it was something that only could be experienced as it unfolded live. Like there's just no way to script a moment like that where
I don't know how it happens.
Has advantage. And Salt Lake, for all of kind of their panic elsewhere in this game and how much Winchell's defense kind of got to the number one offense throughout the semifinal matchup, that last drive is so composed. I know Minnesota's playing prevent defense. I know that they're sitting back waiting for the Hail Mary. Salt Lake has the opportunity to take chunk yardage, but just the way in which they wind up the field and don't sort of give away the hand of where they're going to make their release from in order to attack the end zone. Mm-hmm. It was just so emblematic of how Salt Lake has played throughout the season, where they're going to continue to stretch the width of the field. They're going to continue to kind of like use all the pieces. I think 6 of the 7 Salt Lake players on the line touched the disc. And obviously Clinton just touches it right at the end. But something like almost all their players on that lineup got a piece of it. And that's just, that's not how most of those buzzer beater scenarios work, right? It's like watching in the NBA a good set play drawn up for the end of a quarter or something versus the majority of bad ones. Like, there's so many instances where teams have that opportunity and they just absolutely flub it. They just... They either huck it too soon and they put up a warning track huck and it just doesn't make it, or they take too much time and all of a sudden somebody's panicked into a 3-second decision that they don't really want. This was about as optimal as a moment as you could have for setting up what also required a miracle on the other end, which is Clinton elevating to NBA heights and macking it to a wide open receiver. But like, just something about the whole kind of wind and release of that play is like so pleasing to go back and watch, given the rest of that. And even when you wrap it up with the sequence prior, Minnesota's final possession of regulation with that terrific Will Grant huck to Quinn Snyder racing away, and the entire bank of audience members along that sideline just like erupting, and it's, what was it? It was like 17 seconds left or something on the clock at that point.
Yeah, I think it 17.
It felt certain, but for the facts that it's a Minnesota sports team in a playoff game. So unless there's double zeros on the clock, you better not be celebrating anything. And the contours of how the rest of that game went. Where it was
the
just...
chaos of the game. I mean, I feel like Jordan Kerr's Callahan in that game to me is like perfectly emblematic of... The chaos. It was just like...
I wanted to talk about Kerr because I think it's one of the most over...
Kerr went off.
We do not talk about the game or give it the reverence that it deserves. You know, in a game that featured 38 combined turnovers, he was 33-35 from the field. He had 7 assists, 3 goals, and that aforementioned Callahan. And he just looked like... He literally looked in the second half possessed. He was walking around with this furrowed brow and just looking a level.
He was
like,
in the zone,
locked in, and just like he had like a glimmer of a smile at once in the camera, but it was kind of this like almost trickish sort of like devil may care sort of attitude. His ability to lock in and ascend to a different level, I keep going back to that as why I had him listed as my MVP runner-up. And while I often had thoughts of maybe just putting him as MVP in my end-of-season ballot, because that was such a confirmation of, again, his ability to step up into these big games. I know he didn't have the performance they wanted to against New York in the championship game, but it really overclouded how good he was and how much of a rock he was for Salt Lake, particularly in that second half. He had a couple of red zone possessions that you and I always talk about when it comes to Kerr, where he's slicing in these low release flicks or the diabolical step through backhand that he has. He had what's becoming a little bit of a vintage play for him, where he like dives and saves it towards the a sideline and then like comes back and flips a little lefty backhand in the clutch of the game. There is just so many moments where you could see Salt Lake for their youth, and despite having Clinton and Lindsley, who had prior championship weekend experience, that Kerr was the guy they were going to lean on. You know, Lindsley had a couple of nice moments. He also had some mistakes in that game that were pretty costly for Salt Lake. And I felt like they were at times where the Shred were looking to see, is this going to be championship weekend Grant? Is this going to be the guy who's been undefeated in this event in his two previous forays into it? And it was like, no, it's not quite
it's not
that version of him. No, Minnesota does have a little bit of athleticism to put a cap on what he's capable of doing as a playmaker. So we need to kind of go elsewhere, and to see Kerr once again elevate into that role and kind of almost perform like he did, I feel like, in 2022, where it was so clear that everything that they were trying to do successfully in that second half was predicated on Kerr getting the disc and going to work.
Yeah, but I think it made me appreciate him a lot more as a true MVP candidate this year. Because, like, obviously, you know, you take him kind of in the context of the whole season that the Shred had, their offense as a whole obviously was elevated. Like, we talked about all their individual player improvements, how they could have, like, any number of guys could have won most improved player. It did go to Jace Dunabile in the end, but, like, Knoll was fantastic. Jacob Miller was fantastic. But then, like, in that environment at championship weekend, when the offense is looking a little shaky, it's like, okay, we just got to go to our guy, Kerr, you do your thing. And he did it. Like, he rises to that occasion. And yeah, like you said, championship game wasn't great, but he also, I don't think he had a turnover in that game. It was just, he was locked up by Antoine Davis and he couldn't get his normal scoring numbers up. But yeah, he had a fantastic championship weekend, fantastic season, really as good a chance as anyone in my mind to have won the MVP award.
And then on the other side, I wanted to shout out one other individual performance, because who else could it be? Brian Vonoka, B-Von. He's one of those guys I like privately root for. I think if you meet B-Von or you interact with him in any space, he's just somebody who's so easy to start getting along with. He's the epitome mm-hmm. of Minnesota Nice. He just has a kind of smoothness to how he approaches things. But also, if you know him in any capacity, that dude is a shark-blooded competitor. Nobody works out more than him. Nobody takes their fitness more seriously. Nobody takes kind of the holistic part of being an athlete like B-Von does. Like, he is truly, I think, what we think of when we say a team captain, a leader. He is in the weight room with you in every single off-season workout. He's at every practice. He's there at the beginning. He'll be the last one to leave, et cetera, et cetera. I know he made an All-Star Game appearance 2019. I know we talk about his importance to this team a lot. We've talked about how versatile he's been. I was just so glad to see him get that kind of stage to have the game that he did and to make the plays that he did. Because I think it's one of those reminders that people aren't so quick to give Minnesota their due, I think, a lot. Or some of these Central Division teams or various teams that aren't in the, you know, what we consider to be the truly elite caliber, what these perennial sort of championship weekend contenders get to experience as far as like celebrated stars and stuff. But like for that night, B-Von may as well have been Randy Moss or something for Minnesota. I mean, he was just coming down with everything that they threw to him. I felt like he could do no wrong. Those two huge skies are just going to be like imprinted in my mind. And especially just how the crowd even reacted off of him and the team, again, like, he puts in so much to the team that when he makes plays like that, it's not just galvanizing. It's like, that's my dude. That's my general. I'm going to go to war.
Right.
Like, it's There's not just like, level. Oh man, we get fired up whenever X player makes a play. It's like, there's my captain, man. Like he really, and I think getting kind of bookends in the game's environment, like he had a first half sky and then he had the one in the fourth quarter or third or fourth. I can't quite remember at this point, but
it's all a blur.
One in each half, it felt like they were at the perfect moments for Minnesota. It felt like those are the perfect kind of injections of energy that they needed. And it was just, I hate to boil stuff down to this sometimes, but it was cool, man. It's cool to see players of that caliber get moments like that.
No, definitely. And it did come like the two previous games that ended Minnesota's seasons in 2022 and 2021 came against Chicago, those losses in the Central Division Championship games. B-Von, if I remember, did not play well in those games. So seeing him in this environment, like closing the season on a high note and like doing all he could to will them to a potential championship appearance, I thought that was awesome. In front of the home crowd, of course.
Yeah. 2021, he had a good first half. He had the snake in the grass play. He had a couple of nice skies. He did have a couple of critical turnovers in the second half.
He just had some, like, high throwaway games. Yeah, just, like, inefficient. Yeah. He just had some, like, it was, like, I don't know, four or five throwaways in each of those games. But, yeah, I mean, he was, like, clearly the galvanizing presence for Minnesota's offense against Salt Lake.
All right, now we're getting to the fun hypothetical part. We'll each take let's just each take one of these games and flip the result and talk about what that would have meant. Okay. I think the easiest ones, I'm going to walk through it a little bit because I'm going to pick one that I don't think is as evident. So Minnesota Salt Lake, I think that one kind of speaks almost for itself. Minnesota getting a home championship game, I just think would have brought an added layer and just energy level. I don't know how well the wind chill do in a championship game against New York, given how New York is playing. So as kind of much of a wallpaper shift as it might be, an aesthetic shift of getting a home crowd again at a championship game for the first time since 2018, that would have been fun. I don't know that it really like changes much to put Minnesota in the title game over Salt Lake. I think that we got the version of the two best teams we had seen all season in the 2023 title game. So that's kind of my thoughts there. Carolina, DC, also super fun game, super important, I think, as far as establishing where two powerhouses are. If DC wins that game and Carolina doesn't, Carolina's still making South Division playoff game. DC is probably still behind New York for hosting East Division playoff game. Like, doesn't really shift much there. I'll kind of leave it up to you between the other three. So you got the West Division game between Colorado, Salt Lake, week three, New York, DC, and the South.
I mean,
and,
the South one to me is the most interesting. Like, Holzmeier just hangs on to that disc. I mean, I was looking back. So Atlanta would have been, they would have had just two losses on the year. Minnesota also would have had two losses, but Atlanta had a better point differential. So yeah, Atlanta would have come in as a three seed to play against Salt Lake in the semis. It would have been Minnesota, New York in the other semi game. I don't know. Atlanta, Salt Lake to me is like a really, really intriguing battle, because the way Atlanta played New York earlier in the season, like, they looked really good against them, particularly in the second half of that game. Like, New York kind of had an early lead and they just sort of held it throughout the game, but it was a really good second half, and Atlanta was just like, they were just peaking. I mean, they had those two late wins against Carolina at the end of the regular season, having another big win against Austin that would have been like, you know, taking down two of the top five or six teams in the league in a span of a few weeks. And then with all that momentum, taking on Salt Lake, which just, it was a team that looked unprepared for championship weekend. Like, right? Like, they just didn't look like how they were playing all season. And I would have been just really curious to see what version of Atlanta we got in that championship weekend environment. If we got like sort of a, you know, a little bit of a shaky offense, defense, nerves, whatever, then that's kind of what we saw from the other three newcomer teams, Austin, Minnesota, and Salt Lake. Like, none of them looked really good at championship weekend. No one did except New York's defense, really. I just think there could have been potential for more chaos, but also potential for Atlanta to like really cement themselves as a true contender against Salt Lake. I don't know. I'm kind of leaning towards Atlanta could have beaten Salt Lake in advance of the championship.
I was going to ask you, my question is, do you think Atlanta's ceiling is slightly higher than Salt Lake's? It's an absurd question on its face. let's just put that out there. Like, Salt Lake won their games. They got to the championship game. They deserve all that. They acquitted themselves. Hustle, once again, terrific opportunity to advance to championship weekend, and they let it slip through their fingers, just like in 2021. So,
yeah.
But, like, I'm inclined to say that I think Atlanta's best game might beat Salt Lake.
Right, and I just think, like, an Atlanta-New York championship game would have been really enticing, potentially. You know, maybe the same thing would have happened, and New York would have just run away with it regardless, and realistically, they were probably always going to win the title this past year. But yeah, I don't know. There was something to Atlanta and like seeing them playing at their ceiling. I guess, you know, we wanted Salt Lake to be able to play at their ceiling at championship weekend. We just didn't get that. So yeah, I kind of like go to Atlanta. Could we have seen the best version of Atlanta at championship weekend? I don't know.
Like, is week eight Salt Lake, what they did against Colorado, you know, the season low eight turnovers, is that their best version? And does that beat the best version of Atlanta that we saw this year? I don't know. Like, I guess I was so destabilized, like, to your saying of, like, what Salt Lake looked like at championship weekend this year and how dissimilar it was from the rest of their performance.
Right. It was a different team.
I'm wondering if they would experience the same sort of trepidation against another top-flight competitor. I don't know.
Yeah. But, like, Atlanta obviously has not been great at, you know, rising to the occasion in these huge games. But if they got that win over Austin, maybe that would have been the monkey off their back, and I think they would have been like so much itching to face New York and have another shot at New York, given the way their 2021 season ended and given how the way New York beat them earlier in the regular season. Like, that to me had a little bit more juice of an enticing potential storyline. But we'll never know. That's why it's the what if game.
Yep. Yep. I mean, so I have two choices. I had one of these already is going to be my pick. The one that I'm leaving still on the cutting board is the Week 8 West Division matchup between Colorado and Salt Lake. I think that would have been a fantastic what if still, like, you know, again, if Colorado wins by two, if then they take the regular season series, if Salt Lake loses one more game, let's say, outside of the Empire game, let's say they lose that Week 10 game at LA that they only won by two. Let's say that one flips. Let's say Colorado then gets the home field advantage for the West Division Championship game for the second straight year. Do they maybe get healthy enough with that extra 2 weeks of preparation after the first round of playoff games? Do they maybe coalesce a little bit more into themselves, get back a little bit more? Because one of the things that was so apparent from Colorado in that first round playoff loss to LA was that they just didn't seem to have any sense of themselves. Whereas LA was absolutely on this ascendant streak of the second half play that they had been building on. Whereas the Summit were kind of reinserting pieces that they had lost throughout various points of the year. I remember Saeed Semrin was trying to slot back into the lineup after missing the second half of the regular season. There was just a lot of uncertainty around Colorado. And so maybe with the added confidence of a home playoff game in the West Division final, not just an opening round game against a white hot LA team, but kind of as the divisional favorites, maybe that allows the Summit to step back into where they were in 2022. But again, like, I now question, just talking out loud, like, how high was Colorado's ceiling this year? And I honestly don't know. I don't know that they really did it. We got that one 10-win goal, 10-goal win against Minnesota, but that was Minnesota coming off of a big win the week prior, traveling to the Rockies for the first time. All of the kind of intangibles felt very much in the advantage of Colorado. Minnesota was down a couple of their major offensive players. Abe Coffin was just coming back from his first game after missing a month with a hip injury. Like, there was so much tumult for Minnesota at that point in the season, whereas, like, Colorado's biggest win felt over a very disadvantaged opponent. So, like,
I mean, Colorado, I just feel like they were, the whole year, they were just like figuring themselves out. So in my mind, I don't know how much home field advantage, or I guess home field advantage in the West Division Championship game would have mattered, considering they lost their home game against LA. Like, I just think it was Salt Lake's division this year. Like, they played the most consistently. They played the cleanest offensive games we saw from that division. And they just never, there wasn't much uncertainty, I guess, in the context of the West Division. The uncertainty only came when they got to championship weekend and had to play these other opponents. But yeah, I don't think, I don't know, it's hard to think that Colorado had a clear path to winning the division this year.
So we cut that one, we leave it on the floor. The one that we're left with is Week 3, New York, D.C. And I actually think that this is bigger than the South Division Championship game getting reversed.
No, it's not. They would have been so fired up. New York would have been so fired up the rest of the season. They would have been winning by like 10
points. They would have been vulnerable. I think so much of New York's perceived invincibility is exactly that. It's a perception. You could even see it in this year's championship game when Salt Lake stepped on the field and just started committing all these unforced errors that they hadn't all year. And it was basically because the Empire intimidated them out of their shoes in the first quarter, you know, and just blew the game wide open and made it into this romp and basically victory parade to their second straight title. And like, I just think that is so much what goes into people's heads. I think New York is a fantastic team, but I still think that they're beatable. And I think if DC gets this as kind of the comeuppance after they were so close in last year's East Division title game, and if they sort of confirm all of these new additions, if the Ben Yotsky alone doesn't happen, if like that play doesn't happen, DC somehow gets a turnover and then converts on the other end and wins that game by the same, basically exact same score, 20-19, I think that does shift a lot. I think that, you know, you could leave in Babbitt having his terrific performance. It kind of gets put into a little capsule and tossed aside. Cool, Jeff, you screamed at the front cone. What does that mean? We got the dub. See you later. You know, like, it's one of those things where, again, we're on the vibes episode. It would just manifestly change how much of how we look at this stuff, right? Like how much we perceive that to be the kickoff to Babbitt's MVP campaign, how much we see it as, well, DC finally figured out a way to make big plays in these rivalry games against New York, but it adds up to the exact same result. Like now we would have more of a data confirmation of, hey, you can punch back at New York. You can out big play them down the stretch, which is how the Breeze were so effective in the second half of that game. I don't know, man. Like, I just think it transforms it too, where it's like, maybe Osgar has the exact same stat line, but we say, hey, we can just absorb a Ryan Osgar perfect from the field, 450 throwing yards, 9 total scores, and walk away with a win. Like, so much of that then defeats so much of how I think we look at New York, which is we bolster them afterward by talking about all these great individual performances and how they shut down the other team. And I just think that, like, if one team were to get over this hump the past two seasons and sort of give a blueprint for how it can be done, I think maybe it does change. I think maybe Philly does find a slightly less confident New York team down Osgar 2 weeks later and wins that game that went to overtime. I'm not, again, this is all hypothetical. It didn't happen. The true reality is that New York is now the two-time reigning champs and have won 30 straight, right?
Yeah, 30, it would be 30.
30 straight. They've tied Toronto. One more win to secure the all-time record, but they're tied with the 13-14 Toronto Rush for longest. I just, like, again, all of that goes away. Like, all these ways in which we talk about and contextualize New York just evaporates. And we get this more renowned sense of, or more pronounced, I should say, sense of DC is the second best team, or DC might be the best team. And I think that that just, like, manifestly changes how the last, 13 weeks of the season go. Like, maybe DC does come into week 10 with a different attitude and get a second regular season win against Empire. I don't know. I just, it's one of those things where the close but not enough with New York has just become such a suffocating thing for potential contenders to deal with that I think that alleviates a lot of other teams and how they approach New York.
I don't know. I think I would have viewed that if DC did pull out that win, I would have thought of it as like, okay, if these teams play 10 games in a row, like these rosters play 10 games in a row against each other, New York wins 8 or 9 of them. Like that's, and I would say like, okay, DC got that one win, but the odds to me don't really shift in their future meetings. I still think these players are probably more fired up than ever. They all love winning so much, and they all love beating DC.
So what happens when you start giving them a diet of a loss or two? Like, that's the thing.
I think that maybe fires them up more. I don't think it shakes their confidence. I still think they're the best team ever at closing out games, and I don't really think that changes. I don't think it's going to rattle the confidence of, like, all 7 of their star players that are arguably like the best 7 in the league. Like, I just don't think it can have that deep of an impact, but I get it. I mean, you want to see some vulnerability. You want to see some sign that this team is human, but I don't know. Obviously teams can play close games against them. It's just no one can close games like they do. And I do think even if DC gets a win next year, for example, I don't think that really changes my perception of New York.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's interesting too, because it feels like such a monolith, the way in which they've constructed this winning streak. And it feels kind of almost protected in a certain way. But like, I think about that game, and I know this started before the winning streak, but like the 2021 playoff game against Atlanta, like, what if Atlanta just holds on in that one? How much differently this New York's whole trajectory? Like, I don't know. Like, I think the Empire have built themselves up so much, again, on this diet of winning, that I just wonder what happens to their system. Should they have to tolerate a loss? Should they have
maybe
to meditate on the idea that they aren't perfect and they can't just keep consisting on
my success? My problem is playing the what if game. I can do it with any team except New York. I think that's what my issue is, because that is their identity. They are the team that wins these close games. Like, there is no what if in my mind. Like, that's just what they do, and it's what they will always do. I have a mental block, a mental wall up right there. So sorry I can't participate more in this conversation. But
I mean, you put it perfectly earlier in this episode. You said it's inevitable, right? And here we are.
It is.
The end of another podcast episode where we try to stray away from New York as much as humanly possible.
And by the way, I want to give myself some credit that now that we've broken down the barrier of going back to New York, when we were talking about buzzer beater situations with the 17 seconds left in the Salt Lake game and how they use that time so well, I was gonna call back to the New York DC game at the end of regulation. DC received the pull with like 12 seconds left in regulation, and I don't know if you remember, but Ben Ort just like stands there without a mark on like the 2 yard line, like just outside their own end zone, because New York doesn't mark him and just like plays defense on everyone else, and Ort just has to like throw up this prayer that doesn't even get the full fields. But like DC had time to potentially get up a prayer. And maybe...
Which is also weird because the Breeze are one of the better teams at driving to within attacking distance and allowing like Rowan or somebody to do a baby hammer over the top or to go cross field into a corner. They don't
12 seconds
put it up to a pack.
Yeah, 12 seconds, like, it's not no time. Like, you should be able to advance it at least to get a shot at the end zone, but they didn't and couldn't.
I'd say anything above, like, even 7 seconds is a pretty long time.
Yeah, if you can get, like, two throws off.
Midfield range. At least get to the midfield line to launch something.
Yeah, and I bet New York would have done that if they were in that situation. Maybe we got to credit New York's defense and coaching for the no-mark strategy.
Oh, do we have to credit New York's defense and coaching? Oh, is that what we got to do again?
Good job, New York. Great work.
I don't want to do it anymore. We just let them roll over the entire end-of-season ballots and awards. Like, tired of talking about New York. I'm sure I'm going to have to get over my personal distaste of the issue pretty rapidly.
We all have it.
Talking about them massively going into the offseason. There's already rumors that they're going to be adding another top defensive player through a potential move. Oh. So, yeah.
Wow. All right.
We'll get to the breaking stuff. It'll be interesting. You know, now we're in the deep of the offseason. We've kind of got to peddle these ideas and, like, talk about different things. But I'm excited to start getting a little bit more news. I know last year we were kind of spoiled with all of DC and LA's bombastic
additions.
Carolina bringing in Joe White, Liam Searles-Bowes, Ben Snell, et cetera, et cetera. It'll be interesting to see what this year holds as far as player movement. It'll be hard to match the season going into 2023, but every year seems to leapfrog the last with excitement. And these 5 games, I think, really encapsulated it. I remember, like, after maybe the 2017 season, somewhere around there, kind of having trouble with maybe coming up with a list like this of what really made us captivated following a season. And so it's good to get to this point. It's good to get to this point where we had a healthy chunk of games that we couldn't even get to. But maybe we'll get to them heading into the rest of this deep offseason again. But that'll do it for this episode of Swing Pass. We will not be here next week due to travel constraints. There's a big ownership meeting this next week, and I will be off partially next week. So we're going to take a break from this show. We will be back the week following in the second week of October, but we appreciate you turning in for this episode. We will be with you shortly. We appreciate you. Talk soon. Bye now.